Okay. We're being recorded, but there's no title.
Okay, and then I have to do this. Okay, so this is tonight is lesson number 4. We'll be looking at Messianic Prophecies, lesson number 4, Numbers 23 and 24, the predictions of Balaam. I want to talk a little bit about Balak and Balaam. We're going to look at 4 prophecies. It's one passage, but if you've read that passage before, Balaam is giving 4 prophecies, and they divide in 4 sections. So we're going to look at those 4. And the one that really pertains to the Messiah is the 4th one, but they all lead to it. So let's first, I want to take a look at Balak and Balaam a little bit. Balak, the king of Moab, in that context, is terrified that Israel's army, who just finished defeating his northern enemy's neighbors, the Amorites, in Numbers 21 and Deuteronomy 2, 26 and through 3, 11, might try. He's afraid that he might try to invade Moab. So Balak appears powerless before Israel, and he's terrified, as you can see in, for instance, Deuteronomy 2:25. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the peoples everywhere under the heavens, who when they hear the report of you shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. He does not know that God's plan, that according to God's plan, Moab is not given to Israel. That in God's plan, Moab is not given to Israel. That you can read in Deuteronomy 2:9. Then the Lord said to me, "Do not harass Moab nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession." So Balak is kind of freaking out, and he's got a, every time I read this, every time I read this passage, I think of how often do we try to solve our own problems and not rely on the Lord. And they're like, well, I know God is on my side. I know God is going to help. But what if I get a head start? Or what if I do this and then maybe he can join me? That's the human nature. So I somewhat can relate to I don't know how far I would go, but he's like trying to take matters in his own hands. And we always say, I trust the Lord. The Lord is going to help me. The Lord is my deliverer. The Lord is my fortress. We have all those scriptures to encourage us. Yet we still have a tendency to do a little bit of what he did. So, we don't want to be too hard on him because we can find ourselves in the same situation sometimes. Maybe not so drastic, but it does happen. Balak believed that no military might of any kind could defeat Israel. He then decided to attack them in a spiritual realm. In an effort to keep Israel out of Moab, he decides to commission a pagan diviner, shame on him, an astronomer. So, that's what he does, and he hires the help of Balaam, the son of Beor. We read about Balaam in Numbers 22, at the beginning of Numbers 22. According to biblical and extra-biblical records, he had a very strong reputation for succeeding in cursing people. A curse of Balaam was irreversible. You don't want to mess with Balaam, okay? So Numbers 22:5. So he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river, in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me. Now, therefore, please come, curse these people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Balaam was an internationally known prophet and diviner, using animal entrails and observing natural phenomena to determine the will of the gods. You notice I put gods in the plural with a small g, okay? He lived in Pethor, northern Mesopotamia. Keep that in mind. Balaam is the nickname given to this character by the scribes, and it means devourer of the people. Moses knew about Balaam's prophecy. Numbers 31:16, we read, "Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord." Now, What's interesting, it's just a little additional information about Balaam from rabbinic tradition and rabbinic writings. Balaam is often seen as one of the seven Gentile prophets of the Bible. Beor, his father. Job and Job's four friends, that's 4 and 1, 5 and 1, 6, and Balaam makes a seventh. Balaam had a reputation amongst Gentiles that rivaled that of Moses with the Jewish people. He had a very, very big reputation. Not necessarily all good, but he was known all across the land. He was first able to interpret dreams, then he became a magician, and eventually a prophet, and a diviner, and all those things that were kind of intertwined and linked together. In the Talmud, there are references about Balaam in the Talmud, some good, some not so good. Balaam is described, and I put all the in parenthesis, the Talmudic reference in case somebody wants to go dig up the Talmud, because you all have a full version of the Talmud at home, so I want to make sure that, okay. So I want the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud, both of them, yeah. Which is the one that most Jewish people use, by the way? Babylonian, that's the completed one. The Jerusalem or the Yerushalmi is incomplete, unfinished. The Bavli or Babylonian Talmud is complete. So that's why when we refer to the Talmud, it's usually meaning the Babylonian Talmud. Anyway, and those are what the references are about. And so Balaam is described as having the unique ability among mankind to know when God is about to get mad. Now, mind you, we're not pulling verses from the Bible here. I'm talking about Jewish commentary on Jewish writings, the Talmud. So a lot of it is legend and stories and discussions, and very often on one page of the Talmud, you've got several rabbis, and you know, if you get two Jews in one room, you get at least two opinions, right? Three. Okay, good. I'm glad. I always do it that way now, so people can correct me. Of course, two Jews, three opinions. So, but, you know, he's described as having the ability to know when God's wrath would come, and this is what he wanted to bank on to have the Jewish people cursed. He was hoping that he would figure out when God was going to get mad, and he would just bank on that. That's what the Talmud tells us. Also, the Talmud tells us that retells the time when the law was given to Israel and God's voice shook the earth so that kings went to Balaam because they were scared and asking Balaam if a second flood was about to happen, which of course he answered negatively. He said, no, there's not going to be another flood. So that's a kind of a positive way where Balaam actually helped people. What's going on here? Is God mad? And Balaam apparently gave him an answer. Even though Balaam did not curse Israel, he's referred to as the wicked one very often in the Talmud. I found that fascinating. There's also a reference to Balaam as possibly being Yeshua pre-incarnate. And the stretch in the Talmud, and the stretch here is beyond a stretch. It's a mix of a stretch, wishful thinking, and circular reasoning on a bad day. Okay, what it is it's based on a Talmud passage, which is based on one verse of the Bible, Psalm 55:24, when a certain Rabbi Hanina was asked how old Balaam was, and he used that verse, which is a few lines below that, but thou, O God, will bring them down to the pit of destruction. Men of bloodshed and deceit will not live out half their days, but I will trust in thee. So he was asked by one of his disciples, or by somebody, as the Talmud tells us, how old Balaam was. And he used that verse to explain that Balaam was probably about 33 or 34 years old, about Yeshua's age when he died. And the parallel is made because Yeshua is believed to have been a deceiver to Jewish people. And it says, like, those who deceive will not live a full life. And so, I mean, there's like, how do you link Balaam to Yeshua that way? I mean, like I said, it's a really big stretch, okay? Even commentaries that talk about this, and that even in the Talmud, they say, they don't say we're pushing it, but they say in their own way, they say nobody's really sure this is a possible way of looking at it, but nobody wants to bet the house on it. I mean, they're just like, oh, hell. But it's interesting that it would even be there, that you would look at somebody who is not really a positive character in the Bible, and then you look at somebody like that, and because they apply a verse to him who died at a young age, it says that he was of bloodshed and deceit, and they said, aha, Yeshua was a deceiver because he took people away from Judaism. It's possibly talking about Yeshua there. So it's very, it's a big stretch. Okay, back to the biblical account. Balaam just encountered the God of Israel through his donkey. I know it sounds funny, but it's the truth. It's the truth. The donkey that spoke to him in chapter 22 of Numbers. And he's not immediately interested in cursing the Jews. He's going to kind of figure out, he's going to try to go at it, but it's not going to come out the way he's hoping. Numbers 22, 1 through 13 shows us how, after hearing from God, Balaam first rejects Balak's offer to curse Israel, followed by a second request with more bribes. The second request is accepted by Balaam after he hears from God again. The condition for Balaam to go is that he would speak only the words that God gives him, and he's hoping that God will give him a curse for Israel. And this sets the stage for the four prophecies of Balaam. So, let's look at them. We have, I didn't even try that, but I had one on each page. Look at that. Look at that. I didn't even try that, but they start on the top of each page. I just realized that. Very nice, Olivier. Okay. Somebody's got to compliment me. Okay. The four prediction of Balaam. Many scholars actually look at this passage as being up to seven prophecies of Balaam, but the last one, number four, is made of three mini sections of prophetic sections that most scholars say, you know what, those three make one big one. So it's like one, two, three, four. That's the way you look at it. So you could really divide and subdivide into seven, but most people look at the four predictions of Balaam, the last one being made of three different mini sections. And we're going to look at it the same way, four. As we will see in this study, there also seems to be a dramatic progression in the content of the prophetic utterances. The first three are all requested by Balak, and the fourth is given by Balaam without Balak's request. But also the first two, it's different ways of dividing them. The first two oracles pertain to Israel, and the last two pertain to Israel's king. And the last of the two, you know, number four, is the one that talks about a star in the future. That's what we're going to be looking at at the end of this lesson, that we'll talk about that star. First prediction, Numbers 23, 7 through 10, the irrevocability of Israel's blessing. And the text says this. He took up his discourse and said, "From Aram Balak has brought me Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Come curse Jacob for me," which is of course another name for Israel, "and come denounce Israel. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed, and how can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced?" I guess he had a little idea of Genesis 12:3, and then, you know, I mean, that's an interesting verse that he would say that. As I see him from the top of the rocks, and I look at him from the hills, a people who dwells apart, he's talking about the Jewish people here, and will not be reckoned among the nations, separated, set aside by God. That's what he's saying here. Who can count the dust of Jacob, or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like this, like his. Right at the start here in verse 8, Balaam points out that he cannot curse those who God has not cursed. It is clear that based on the foundation of the Abrahamic covenant, Israel is to be blessed by God, and consequently, as we've heard many times, all who bless her will be blessed, and those who curse her will be cursed. Still going on today. What's going on in the days of Abraham, what's going on with Balaam, it's still valid today. It hasn't changed. Okay? We know that. God doesn't change. The theme of this first oracle is the blessing of Israel. It is irrevocable. Thus, an attempt at cursing is highly ineffective. Doesn't stop many people throughout the ages to trying to curse Israel, but it, on the long run, it's ineffective. It will never succeed. As bad as it gets for the Jewish people in Israel, people will never succeed in cursing Israel to the point of completely eradicating the Jewish people eradicating Israel from the map. It's never going to happen. And, you know, and I heard that recently, and I agree. I heard it or read it. I think I read it. Even if
even if,
which is very unlikely, the Jews would lose the land and would be, you know, put in a diaspora again, God is still not going to destroy Israel, because Israel is not just about the land. It's a people. It's a people in the land. And they don't have to be attached to one another, so in a way that all the Jews would have to be in the land for the people to be Jewish. You're not Jewish because you're in the land. You're Jewish because you're born a Jew. So I'm a Jew who was born in France. I live in America. I don't live in Israel. So even if the whole land was given away, Israel would still exist. So now that's very unlikely, of course, but that the land would be given away completely. Although, you know, when you look at the news, you think, well, you know, a lot of things could happen. But okay, let's not get into that. Okay, so a point not to be missed is that because of his covenant relationship with Israel, God could not allow a permanent curse on Israel, and Balaam curses at the reputation of being irreversible. Not that God could stop Balaam, but there's a lot of things that you see in life that God could stop, but God allows. God allows things, but God will also not allow certain things to happen, knowing that because he has allowed certain people to do certain things, that he could not allow them to do what he has. I don't know if it makes any sense, but he cannot allow them to do what they usually do, because that would cut short his plan for his people. But God could have, I don't necessarily want to open a big can of worms here, but God could have stopped the Holocaust from happening. For some reason, he allowed it to happen. That's all I'm going to say. That's just one example. But here, he's not going to allow Balaam to curse Israel at that time in history. Another point is made in verse 9 when we read that Israel dwells alone, not reckoned among the nations. Israel's ability to dwell in the land might depend on their obedience to God. Nevertheless, their ownership of the land only depends on God's irrevocable promise of the Abrahamic covenant. Kind of goes along with what I just told you. So Jews are not seen by God as a people of a specific place, but descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, inside or outside the land. You do not have to live in Israel to be Jewish. And by the same token, living in Israel doesn't make you Jewish. Even Balaam sees God's, you need an apostrophe S here. I got to put some typos here and there, otherwise you won't write anything in your notes. Even Balaam sees God's promise of blessing, and in the end of the oracle in verse 10b, he wishes he could benefit from it too. So the first one is like, he says, well, you know, I'm not going to try to curse Israel, because Israel's blessing is irreversible. Then in the second one, we find out a little more about the source of Israel's blessing on page 5. The second prediction, Numbers 23:18-24. All throughout the second oracle, we read that the source for Israel's blessing is God himself. We know that, and Balaam is actually voicing that out in that prophecy. The text says from Numbers 23:18-24. And I read, "Then he took up his discourse and said, 'Arise, O Balak, and hear. Hear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent.'" That's a verse that's a good verse to have, because when you talk about, you know, God can't lie and God doesn't change his mind, that's an interesting verse right there to make a note of, Numbers 23:19. "God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. He has blessed, then I cannot revoke it." Again, you know, the blessing cannot be taken away. We get from the text here that it definitely comes from God. "He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of the wild ox. For there is no omen against Jacob," Israel, "nor is there any divination against Israel. The proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Behold, a people rises like a lioness. As a lion, it lifts itself. It will not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain." I might have, if you have a Bible, I might have dropped the word "at" the proper time on verse 23 here. I don't know why it's not there, but I'm just going to make a little note here. Sometimes when I put those, but it's not critical, but you might want to double check that. We might be missing the word at the proper time. In verse 19 and 20, God is seen as not changing his mind. There is a comparison between the constant changing of mind of Balaam and the immutability of the Lord. You know, divine versus human. I really like that verse. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. We do. We do lie. Of course I don't. Well, that was a lie right there. And we change our mind all the time. There is a... he's also seen as being on Israel's side in verse 21. God brings them out of Egypt and also protects them like the horn of a wild ox. Again, in this oracle, the writer reiterates the fact that Israel cannot be cursed because God won't allow it. Verse 23, for there is no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. At the proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. God is protecting Israel. Eventually, using the analogy of a lion devouring its prey, Israel will be victorious. Verse 24, at this point, the would-be victim of the curse of Balak and Balaam becomes the instrument of the destruction of its own enemies. The third one now, we're shifting from prophecies against Israel, which really turn out to be not against Israel, but prophecies on the topic of Israel, I should say, now to two prophecies on the topic of the king of the Jews, the king of Israel. And those are the ones that are going to be leading us they're going to end up being messianic prophecies about Yeshua himself. The third one, the seed from Jacob, third oracle is the first of two concerning Israel's messianic king. Numbers 24, 5 through 9. Fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens beside the river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water will flow from his bucket, and his seed will be by many waters. And his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt. He is for him like the horns of the wild ox. He will devour the nations who are his adversaries, and he will crush their bones in pieces and shatter them with his arrows. He crouches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion he dares. Who dares rouse him? Blessed is everyone who blesses you, and cursed is everyone who curses you. By now, Balak is getting pretty upset. Because Balaam is, every time Balaam is opening his mouth, I can picture Balak going like, come on, curse them. Just blow them out of the water, curse them. And Balaam is going, I'm going to curse him and bless you. And it just, you know, God has just given him the words. In verse 5 and 6, we read about the fruitfulness of Israel. Again, we see the theme of abundance and blessing being described here. Like valleys that stretch out, like gardens beside the river. Then for the rest of the oracle, we read about the future king of Israel, who will have an exalted kingdom. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. That's verse 7. And verse 8 and 9, the future king is said to be brought out of Egypt. You have a reference, a cross-reference in Matthew 2, 13 and 15, as well as in Hosea 11, 1. Matthew 2, 13 and 15. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise and take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him. And he arose and took the child and his mother by night, and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod. That was what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, out of Egypt did I call my son. So he's going to be like the horns of a wild ox and to be like a lion. All these three descriptions were used earlier about Israel in the previous prophecy as well. And finally, in 9b, Balaam reiterates the promise again of the Abrahamic covenant in a way, basically, and in a way curses Balak and himself as well. So things are not going too well for Balak. There's one more chance here. And it's going to get even worse, or even better, we should say. The fourth prediction in Numbers 24, 15 through 24, the star and the scepter. Now, we had already a theme of the scepter. You remember when we found that theme of the scepter? What prophecy it was?
Genesis 49:10.
The scepter shall not depart from Judah until the one to whom it belongs, until Shiloh comes. Shiloh meaning the one to whom it belongs, which is approved all across the board by 99.9% of Christian theologians and commentators and rabbis and Jewish commentators, that this is a reference to King Messiah. Many different references that I gave you in that lesson about the fact that they all agree. So we're going to see, we're going to revisit this theme of the scepter. We're also going to look at a star here. And it's interesting here how it all comes together. This is the last of the four oracles, and it has the most significance as it pertains to the first coming of the Messiah. Numbers 24, verses 15 through 24. He took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered." And here's the key verse. "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and tear down all the sons of Shet. Edom shall be a possession, Seir, its enemies, also will be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly. One from Jacob shall have dominion, and will destroy the remnant from the city." And he looked at Amalek, and took up his discourse, and said, "Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall be destruction." And he looked at the Kenite, and took up his discourse and said, "Your dwelling place is enduring, your nest is set in the cliff. Nevertheless, Cain will be consumed. Long will Ashur keep you captive." Then he took up his discourse and said, "Alas, who can live except God has ordained it? But ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Ashur, and will afflict Eber, so they also will come to destruction." So, we have a description of all those people that are going to be destroyed here. The key verse we're going to want to really focus on is verse 17. "The king will come in a distant future. I see him, but not now." Verse 17. And we already know from Genesis 49:10 that he will come from Israel, from Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. The scepter used again here is the symbol of royalty. So we have the same thing being picked up here. "He will destroy Israel's enemies," verse 17 and 18, "and have dominion." We also notice that the coming of this future king will be heralded by a star. Now this star idea is interesting here. In Matthew 2, 1 and 2, we read, "Now after Yeshua was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him.'" How many Magi came?
We don't know.
A bunch.
You guys are good. How many gifts, how many different kinds of gifts they bring? Three. That's the misconception. You know, they brought, you know, myrrh, frankincense, and gold. And 17 of them could have brought myrrh, and 149 gold, and 2 frankincense. And, you know, but by because of the three gifts, we have the, you know, "We three king of Orient," you know, like, don't get me started. You already knew that. You're way ahead. Okay, that was a little test. In this passage, we read that the Magi were led to the newborn Yeshua by the visibility of a star. Magi were Babylonian astrologers. That's what they were. How would they know about the birth of a king with the help of a star? But more importantly, why would Babylonians want to worship the Jewish king? Is the star a real literal star, or does it describe something else? In studying the passage, we find out that it is the personal star of the king of the Jews. It appears and disappears. It moves from east to west. It moves from north to south, and it hovers over one single house in Bethlehem. Any star that would do that from outer space would probably crush whatever. I mean, a star can't do that. I mean, we see a little dot of light in the sky, but a star is like huge. Okay, it's like a planet, or it's like, I mean, I'm not a. I don't know all those things, but all I know is a star is not just a dot of light. Okay, if a star was to do any of those things, you know, like to just hover over one house in Bethlehem, it's just not going to happen. So what is this star? In Greek, the root meaning of the word star is brilliance or radiance. The star in question is not a literal star, but the radiance of the Shekinah glory of God, the Shekinah glory of the Lord, that is radiating over the house, over the place where Yeshua was born in Bethlehem. So, it still doesn't explain how the Magi got, we're here because, we saw the light. You know, looks like somebody was home. There was light in, the light was on. So what's going on? Well, why would Gentile astrologers decide to worship the Jewish Messiah? For this, we have to go back to the book of Daniel, written in Babylon. Daniel 9:24-27 is the only place in the Tanakh giving us an exact time of the first coming of the Messiah. Additionally, Daniel saved the life of many Babylonian astrologers when in Daniel 2 he interpreted the king's dreams. I mean, you remember? It was like basically nobody can tell me what's going on here. And Nebuchadnezzar had he had a short fuse. If you did not either tell him what his dream was, or if you didn't do what he wanted, or if you did not bow to him, you're done. You're toast. So he had a short fuse. So Daniel saved the life of many Babylonian astrologers in Daniel 2 when he interpreted the king's dream. Some of these astrologers turned away from worshiping the stars, most likely, and started to worship the God of Israel. From that point on, some astrologers followed the Bible and knew about the coming of the Messiah from Daniel. What about the star? For that, we have to return to Numbers and look at Numbers 24:17. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter shall rise from Israel and shall crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down all the sons of Shet. Balaam was from Babylon and most likely an astrologer. He was a diviner, a magician, a prophet, an astrologer. And all, in those days, that kind of ungodly man that was not a prophet of God, really, although his prophecy was used by God and kept in the Bible, but his reputation was not built on being another Ezekiel or another Isaiah. He was not a prophet of God. So Balaam was from Babylon and most likely an astrologer. In Numbers 24, he equates the star with a scepter. Scepter is a symbol of royalty. Thus the star, who is also the coming scepter, will be a king. And there is little doubt that Balaam kept the information to himself. Future generations of Babylonian astrologers were made aware of a star to follow to come worship the new king of the Jews. So it's not astrology that helped the Magi, but it is the revelation from the God of Israel. Because some people say, does that validate astrology? No, it doesn't validate astrology. But that star was linked to the scepter that would come. So there's a king that's going to come, and there is a star or a radiance that's going to direct you. And that's from, the connection is between the book of Numbers and the book of Daniel. And so there's, do you see how this all comes together? So the messianic signet, yes. Bonnie has a question. Uh-oh. She always asks questions that I cannot answer. For the record. It's a good question. It's a very good question. And by next week, I'll have a good answer. Okay, Bonnie, you cannot ask questions anymore. We're being recorded here, okay? You're humbling me week after week. You're humbling me by force. Okay, no, I will have an answer for you. And I don't have a... it's not Seth. It's right. Sheth, okay? So, yeah. I'll get that to you next week. Or I even email you before. The messianic significance of the predictions of Balaam. Israel's past experience, Oracles 1 and 2, prefigures the king's experience, Oracles 3 and 4. As we see the parallel between the two by the usage on both of Egypt, the ox, and the lion. The oracles deliberately allude to the other messianic passages and reference, such as Numbers 24:7-9, the seed, Genesis 3:15, Numbers 24:9, lion, lion of Judah. The oracles point to one greater than David, and that would have to be King Messiah himself. Remember the Targums? I mentioned to you the Targums. They're like Aramaic paraphrase. Thank you. Aramaic paraphrase of books of the Bible. Targum Onkelos and Targum Jonathan both saw Oracles 3 and 4 as messianic passages. From Numbers 24:17, we can deduce that Messiah will be a king. So we're moving on. Next time we will look at a prophet like Moses. We're going to find out that Messiah is also going to be a prophet. So now we've got, he's a human being, a descendant from the seed of Abraham, from the line of Judah, that will come before 70 AD. Thou will be a king. And so he's a Jewish man who's going to come before 70 AD, who's going to be a king of the Jews. That's narrowing it down pretty much. A lot. Quite a bit. Okay? And so it's just amazing that even that in itself, just that, disqualifies many other false messiah. I was looking at three false messiah that came, the main most famous three false messiahs of Judaism. Any names come to mind?
Yohanan ben
Zakkai was actually the man, the rabbi who restructured Judaism after the temple was destroyed. Rabbi Akiva proclaimed that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah in 132 AD at the Roman revolt. Of course, he was not the Messiah. That was clear by the result of the revolt. What's interesting is that Rabbi Akiva, to this day, is still recognized by Jewish people as one of the great rabbis of the faith. Like, you know, Maimonides and Rashi, you know, Rambam, Rashi, Rabbi Akiva. He's one of the great. Yet, he misdiagnosed, so to speak, or he just gave the title of Messiah to a man who was not Messiah. Even after he did that, they kept him as, he's a great rabbi, a Jew, and everything. Here's a Jewish man like me who says, like, I think this rabbi is the Messiah. And then I'm not even Jewish anymore. There's one that's proven to have pointed the finger towards a man and say, hey, Jewish people, follow him, he's the Messiah. And he was not. And he's still recognized as one of the greatest rabbi of history. It just doesn't seem to be fair. Not that I want to be recognized as a great rabbi, that's not what I'm saying. But how can somebody who was wrong that much about Jewish people in history has proven it, could still be considered a great rabbi, and then somebody like me or other Jewish believers saying, like, hey, we think Yeshua of Nazareth is the Messiah, and why are we rejected without even given a chance to share and to give proof from the Bible? It just doesn't seem to be equal. Right, exactly. It's a good point. Another false Messiah. Since we're talking about the Messiah here, I just want to add those. I mean, we have a little more time. Is in 16. I think it's 1626. I wrote it on. Hold on, I have it right here. 1626. 1626 to 1676, he lived to be 50 years. His name was Shabbatai Zvi. Shabbatai Zvi was in the East. He was a Jewish leader in the Ottoman Empire, and he proclaimed to be the Messiah. And then he was forced, and people followed him. He had a following of Jewish people that actually started a, we talked about that in my class on anti-Semitism, actually. It started a following known as the Sabbateans. A small group of Jewish people followed Shabbatai Zvi, and they're known to this day as the Sabbateans. They followed him, and then, 10 years before his death, he was 40, in 1666, he was forced to convert to Islam, and he did. And his followers, not all of them, but many of them, continued to follow him. When I think of Shabbatai Zvi, just let me finish my thought. When I think of Shabbatai Zvi, I think of other people, and I'm not going to name any names, who come out of nowhere and are very charismatic in a non-religious meaning and have no credentials, and people will just follow them and put them in power regardless of what they do or promise to do or don't do, and it's just because of their personality. And to me, in a sense, it's a dry run for what the Antichrist is going to be. Like, you know, coming out of nowhere, but the people are going to go like, wow, look at this guy, look what he's accomplishing. Jews and Arabs get along, the temple is being rebuilt. Arabs are helping the Jews rebuild the temple. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but, you know, almost. Yet, no credential, except that this person is outgoing, charismatic, lovable. And so this guy, Shabbatai Zvi, false messiah, he converts to Islam, and many of his people continue to follow him and go along. Yes?
When he converted to Islam, did all his followers convert to Islam as well?
They continued to follow him. I don't know if, I'm not sure that they could have followed him and not convert to Islam. Now, he didn't have, you're not talking about millions here, okay? It was a small group within the Ottoman Empire. It was a small group of Jewish people. It was probably, you know, thousands, but it was not a huge amount. And I don't have an exact number of how many followed him, but it was not just, okay, he's a, you know, he's a traitor, a convert to Islam, we're all going to walk the other way and he's going to be on his own. Some people went like, I don't care, I like the guy. Reminds me of somebody. I'm not going to get political online here, but reminds me of somebody. So that's number two. And then number three, good old man that used to live in Brooklyn until 1994 or 1996. 1902 to 1994, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was the last of a line of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, didn't have a son, so there's nobody after him, and he never claimed to be the Messiah. Many of his followers claimed that he was the Messiah. He never denied it. He was like, hey, you know, I'm not going to say anything. He never said I am, but he never said I'm not. He died in 1994. He was not the Messiah either. Now, what's interesting is that none of these guys were born in Bethlehem. None of these guys were born of a virgin. None of these guys that we know of are from the tribe of Judah, because you would only be able to know if they were from the tribe of Levi. So, you know, but that doesn't seem to be an issue.
Probably because they didn't believe the word of God. They didn't know what it
said. No. First of all, the people that we're talking about here, the 15% of the Jewish people that actually read the Jewish Bible, they are familiar with those different prophecies. And for instance, Genesis 49:10, when it talks about the scepter shall not depart from Judah, and until he comes, the one to whom it belongs, until Shiloh comes. It's pretty straightforward, and the fact that we have to know that it's Judah, and Judah lost its identity, I would say, within one, let's be lenient, within one generation after the destruction of the temple, by 90 AD. So let's say that, Messiah had to come before 90 AD, not 70 AD, because of course, when the temple was destroyed, the day the temple was destroyed, Jewish people from the tribe of Judah didn't go like, I don't know what tribe I'm from. I forgot. That's not the way it happened. It took probably at least a generation for them to not be sure, not be able to prove, for that generation to die off. So let's say maybe not 90 or 100 or whatever. But still, it eliminates everybody after that. The three that I mentioned, the three are not the only ones. Now, Jewish people also have a... There is a belief within... Orthodox, within amongst religious Jewish people, that we can have a Messiah with a small M for each age until the Messiah with a capital M comes and establishes the Messianic kingdom. So, these guys can be, obviously, Bar Kokhba and Shabbatai Zvi were false Messiah. Schneerson, maybe they still think he was a Messiah with a small M. He was a Messiah for that time, and there's going to come another one after him until King Messiah, the one with a big M, comes in and establishes a Messianic kingdom. But that's that's one way to look at it. I think I'm done for this lesson here. So let me do this. We heard it. Let me stop this.
And then